I feel like we need the Jeopardy music or something.
The intro. Bumper music.
I'm really excited to have as our kickoff guest Luis Alvarez of Alvarez Technology Group in Salinas, California. If you want to look them up online, it's alvareztg.com. And Luis is doing some interesting things, so I think you'll really enjoy it. Luis, do you want to start by kind of giving a little intro on your background and why you have too many awards to fit in your cabinets behind you?
Well, one, I've been alive a long time. Alvarez Technology Group actually was born back in 2001 after I had been a partner in another IT company that got sold in 1999, back at the height of the dot-com boom. Good time to sell, by the way. And so I stuck around with the acquiring company for a couple of years under a management agreement, and actually just got tired of working for a public company, because it was a public company that acquired us, and decided to just forge out on my own and start a services-focused business. Our former business was a systems integrator, so it was a lot of project-based stuff. And I wanted to really start exploring, and this was in the early 2000s, this whole concept of managed services, the idea of a flat fee model for providing unlimited services to clients, because there was this tension in the, you know, in the kind of relationships that we had with our clients at the time, where they, you know, guarded every dollar that they spent on us, so much so that a lot of the things that they really needed to get done weren't getting done. And so I said, well, it's best for both of us to come up with an amount of money that lets us make money and not lose money, but also lets us do the things that we need to do to keep your networks up and running. And so we were very early on the managed services train, and, you know, over the last 15 years, continue to innovate on a real regular basis. In fact, I just told our staff in my New Year's message to them that we're embarking on ATG V3, as I call it, because it's time to reinvent ourselves again. And, you know, we'll talk more about it in a few minutes, I'm sure, but you know, the world is changing. The technology landscape that we've all become, very familiar with over the last 10 to 20 years is really morphing much faster than any of us can really understand. And we need to be nimble, and we need to be more willing to stretch ourselves than ever before.
Yeah, and you were really a pioneer back then. I know there was a lot of talk back around 2000, early 2000s. About managed services and more solution focused instead of product or, you know, focused or whatever. But very few people were doing it, you know.
Yeah.
So that must have been an interesting experience to kind of walk through that in a way, you know, kind of a lean business model, I would assume, where you would try things and see how they'd fit.
Exactly. And that's really what I find, is that there's this this fear of making change that is part of our industry. You know, people are, the idea of coming up with a flat fee, for example, for an unlimited all-you-can-eat version of your services scared a lot of people, because they're like, what if they have our guys there, you know, 90 hours a week and we can't service any other clients? And I said, I would tell myself, if that's what it takes, then you have really, really bad clients. It's time to change to something else. And so you have to be able to take those leaps of faith at times, but do it in a way that doesn't jeopardize, you know, the entire company. You're never going to be all in until you're sure that that's the direction that you want to go. So we always have a strategy of piloting any major changes that we want to make in our industry. So for example, right now we're really going after the Internet of Things as an area of focus for us. So as I call it, you know, we're getting out of the data center and getting out into the field, because in our case, we have a lot of, where we're located, we have a lot of ag businesses, so agricultural companies that we work with, and they're embracing technology faster out in their production plants, out in the field, out on their tractors, than they are in the back office. And in fact, they want to get out of the data center business, so they're moving all of that back office stuff into the cloud as fast as possible. So for us to continue to be relevant to them, we need to help them put that technology out in the field in places where they need help, as opposed to just building, you know, more data center networks to them, doing server refreshes and those sorts of things.
Put that technology out.
So we're doing that, but that's a small part of our business right now. The core of our business still continues to be infrastructure managed services, but as this IoT thing develops, and we're already seeing a lot of traction in it, it'll become a bigger and bigger part of our business, but we're going to be smart about it.
But didn't you say that it's like 2-3 years ago, you started getting calls from clients and they're like, hey, we just bought this cool technology to put out in the field. Can you give us some IP addresses? And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Where'd this come from?
Well, you're right. In a way, it reminded me of back when we were a big Novell shop in my former company. You know, Novell was our core offering, and we would get calls from the line managers that say, hey, we're setting up this Windows server because we need to do this application. And I know it's not your guys' job because you handle the Novell side, so we'll take care of setting up this little server, but we need an IP address so we can make it work on our network. Well, it's a similar circumstance. Now, all of this new technology that's being brought into the field or into the warehouse or in the production environment, a lot of those initiatives are being led by the line of business people, not by the IT people. And so they're calling us saying, we've already contracted with this company, you know, they're all cloud-based, they're going to put in a bunch of sensors, so we need about 30 IP addresses, and we need a bunch of drops, and we need to figure this out, or we need wireless throughout the warehouse because we're going to be doing barcoding and scanning for all of our pallets, and you know, the deal's been signed, so we just need you to come in here and make it work. So we were behind the eight ball all the time, right? We were getting these calls on Monday, and they're like, we need to be live by Friday. So we understood that we were not having the right conversations with our clients, and that we were not getting beyond the finance department, if you will, the CFO. If it was a company for which we were providing 100% of their IT support, we were literally just working with the office staff and not really getting beyond that. So we started to send our techs and our account managers out into the field. We said, hey, start engaging with the foreman, start engaging with the plant manager, start engaging with the warehouse manager, and find out from them what they're doing. And it turned out those guys had a lot more money to spend on those initiatives for technology than the traditional, back office operations, because their initiatives actually had a significant ROI. If I can speed up, you know, the way that the pallets are packed, I can make more money. So the business was willing to spend the money on that kind of technology as opposed to saying, well, why do I need to upgrade my servers from Windows 2008 R2 to 2012? They seem to be working just fine.
So let me interrupt you right there. So the audience doesn't really know this, but I mean, you've been around for 15 years, you've grown, you've been successful, very well known in your area. As you mentioned, did a radio show once a week for a couple of years on technology. That's all great. But my impression from working with you, a few years ago, you've got a really good culture. So here you've got these employees and you're good at, having your managers meet with people on a regular basis, keep them engaged. But this was a real shift for people.
Mm-hmm.
And how did your people respond, and what type of things had to change from a leadership process perspective in how you're managing and developing your people to keep them, so when you move them to the forefront of these client needs, client problems, that they can, get the right information, process that, and work it through the rest of your organization, so you have this huge impact on the end user clients. And what happened internally with the leadership pieces? I'm kind of curious.
Well,
you had some difficult decisions, didn't you?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
This wasn't flipping a light switch.
It was not flipping a light switch. And you've heard me say before that, the primary role of a CEO or the leader of any organization is to be the chief visionary officer. You're the one that leads the organization in terms of strategy, in terms of direction, but you have to be clear about articulating that vision and taking into account everybody in the organization.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we did was, as we embarked on this ag tech or IoT initiative, we sat down and we said, okay, how does this impact our professional services group? How does this impact our managed services group? How does it impact our NOC and our help desk? And we took everybody's role into account, and we were able to lay out a vision that explained how everybody was going to be able to participate. and that there was going to be a seat on the bus for all of them if they chose to get on the bus. But we were all getting on the bus, so this was not an option. This was not something that we might do, or people had an option to opt out of it. You know, they were either going to be part of it or not be part of it. But my job was to get them excited and get them to see that that's what the future looked like. And it wasn't just me, you know, going off half-cocked on some random idea that I had in the middle of the night that woke me up, which it actually did, but that's another story. But this was a real tangible shift in our business that was going to have profound impact throughout the organization. And we all had to be on board. So we came up with, you know, the relevant ideas. We came up with engagement plans for our clients and what we wanted to do. We picked it internally. We found a champion who would really be the person, because I couldn't do it. I had too many other things to do it. I mean, not that I didn't want to, but I have too many other things that I have to do as you know, the head of the organization. Yeah. So we found somebody within the organization that really embraced this concept and has led the initiative and been the go-to person for the rest of the team. And so now we're in the process of figuring out now that we've told our clients that we want to be part of their Internet of Things play, their IoT play, the question is, how do we do that? And so now we need to figure out new partnerships, because there are new companies that we've never worked with before that are developing all of this technology. You know, these aren't the Ciscos or the Microsofts of the world. There's a lot of startups and a lot of new initiatives that are especially in agriculture that are coming forth that we have to partner with new companies to deliver. And so the excitement level is there for us, because we see that there's a real purpose going into the future at becoming experts in this particular vertical idea. And so my job is just to continue to you know, look toward the future and find ways to clearly articulate what the road is that we're taking.
Yeah, and you know, two thoughts here. First of all, from my perspective, with Three Strands Leadership that I teach, that you know, you and I have worked on, mm-hmm. you know, the first strand being systematic power, you really relied on your systems for not just technology, but your systems internally with culture. I mean, just to hear how you're engaging your folks, it's all systematic in getting them engaged and defining those processes and type of thing. And the second strand of meaningful work, when you got people's input and you got them involved, I mean, it was my impression is that was incredibly meaningful to them, and linked to the third strand of sincere gratitude. You're basically saying, hey, we value you as a member of the team. We want you involved in these decisions and in this direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And the three strands really speaks to what we do as an organization internally to keep our folks engaged and to keep them wanting to be part of the organization. And it doesn't mean everybody will. I mean, we've had a couple people that said, you know, this is not what I want to do. I still want to play with servers in Iraq, and I still want to, you know, build giant networks, so I'm going to go up to Silicon Valley. We're only 50 miles away from San Jose, so there's opportunity up there. And, I, you know, we wish them well. Hey, I hope it works out for you, but that's not the direction that we're going.
Yeah. The other thing I'm kind of curious is, when I talked with you a couple of years ago, I think it was a couple of years ago, it might have been three, but you had just started to move in the direction of organizing your support folks into teams that supported specific clients. Mm-hmm. And has that continued, and how was that affected by these moves?
It's continued to this point, but we see that has got to change going into the future, because not all of our clients are built the same. So we're going to get a little bit more specific around practice areas rather than teams that service managed services clients. We're going to keep the team concept, but it's going to change in the way that they're focused, rather than being generalists to, you know, a certain number of managed services clients. They're going to be very targeted towards specific technologies within those clients.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And then it sounds really interesting too. And you know, as much as you've got the ag where you know, I'm picturing your guys going out into the field mm-hmm. and, you know, hearing about the problems and helping engineer solutions on the front end now, instead of getting that call of give me some IP addresses.
Yeah. Later on. Well, and whenever you get that call, what it means is that there's a, you know, just from a business perspective, that means that there's another IT or technology partner that your client has engaged with without your knowledge. And that should be concerning. I mean, that, you know, if you're truly a trusted advisor to your clients and you're working with them on a regular basis, there shouldn't be any third parties that they engage with that you don't know about. What we really started to understand is that a lot of these decisions that were being made by lower level managers were being encouraged by senior management in those organizations because, like I said earlier, there was tangible ROI in some of those initiatives. And we weren't part of those conversations at that time. Now we are. Now we're, you know, we're much more wider and deeper with our clients. We're, you know, like I tell my account managers, I want you to be able to walk into that building and nobody question why you're there, as opposed to, you know, giving you a badge and telling you to sit, you know, in the waiting area till somebody comes to get you, because then you're not a trusted advisor. You're just a vendor that they're you know, willing to talk to, but not willing to engage fully.
Yeah, that's a great distinction. That's a great distinction. No, I like it, and I think a lot of people. I don't want our audience, even within the technology industry, but outside of the technology industry, you know, to just say, oh, well, that's ag. You know, that's kind of unique. This works with whatever type of client you're serving. It really does. As a matter of fact, I was reading someone the other day who does company culture branding, mainly branding stuff. And she was commenting, she's down under in Australia. And she was commenting how she was in the middle of nowhere and found a bakery that was doing gluten-free, you know, whatever. Her mm-hmm. specialty, whatever she was looking for. And it was an incredible bakery that had a good clientele because they knew the clientele that they were serving and went after it, you know, got to know them. It's a lot more detailed in technology and what we want to do. But if you're in technology, if you're serving lawyers, you really got to know their business problems.
Yep.
You know, as much as we think of lawyers as being the uber rich, and often they are, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of lawyers out there that are struggling with their bottom line. And if you can know the problems and help them improve it, I mean, that's huge, right? Do you have any lawyers that you serve? I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. We have about a dozen law firms that we manage. You know, some are very large, some are you know, small, two or three partners. But you're right; they suffer from the same sort of technology challenges that any of us suffers from. For example, recently in Monterey County, where we're located, the judges that are in charge of the courts decided that they wouldn't take any more paper for case files, that lawyers had to upload everything electronically and digitally. And you thought that the judges had like cursed them to death the way that some of these attorneys responded, because they really were not prepared to deal with it from a technology perspective. So we worked with them to come up with solutions to make that happen. And when we solved that problem for one of our clients, we had the same solution for everybody. So, yeah. You know, we were able to translate a challenge into an opportunity that would allow us to go back to all of our legal clients and say, hey, we know that you guys have this mandate. We know that it needs to be done by the end of the year. We have a solution that worked for, you know, client X, and lawyers all like and respect each other for the most part. So, you know, saying that you help one firm doesn't mean that the other firm's going to get jealous or say, well, we don't want that. We want something else. No, they want exactly the same thing. They want to be all standardized.
Yeah. And, you know, it reminds me, I've got a client in the D.C., Washington, D.C. area, and they have a number of nonprofit clients. And they have a senior business dev guy. And as we were talking about his plan for 2017, I say, well, here are the two things I want you to do. Number one, I want you to get personally involved with a nonprofit that's meaningful to you. I want you to just go serve, whether it's every 2 weeks, every month, whatever, so you can experience that yourself as a volunteer and someone who's serving. The second thing I want you to do is I want you to go to one of the organizations, I think there's two of them, that serve nonprofits. And I want you to go and join the organization and then find some committee to serve on and just serve. Don't go there to sell. Just go there to serve. And just learn. And, you know, if you do that well, you'll probably get some business out of it. But if you go and serve, just serving, you're going to learn so much more about the problems they're facing. And so you can go in and be more of a trusted advisor, because you can say, oh, yeah, I heard this over at this nonprofit, and, you know, or this is whatever. And I know you've done that. As a matter of fact, I always laugh because you went into Vistage to become a better leader and to learn. But you're such a servant. You have such a servant's heart. I think you ended up, you know, having all of them sign up as your client, you know, sooner or later.
Yeah.
But it's really because of the way you approach it, Lewis. I mean, you don't go to sell. You go to serve, and you're sincere in that.
Well, and I've always been a big believer in giving back to the community that you get so much from. So I've served on a number of nonprofit boards, still do, Monterey Jazz Festival, the Red Cross, several business advisory groups to the local colleges, both the four-year and community college. And I encourage our team internally to do the same. Find something that you're passionate about. Let us know and let us support it. So, for example, we do a lot of charitable giving. Given our size, you know, we're a prime target for a lot of local nonprofits that, you know, want us to sponsor something or contribute. And the way that we prioritize it is, one, something that we're passionate about. Two, a business that a nonprofit that does business with us. So if we have a nonprofit client, we have many of them, and they reach out to us and say, hey, we want you to sponsor this dinner or sponsor this this celebration, we put them at the top of the list. And then next down is the things that our employees are passionate about. So if they have a particular nonprofit, whether it's a, you know, Little League baseball team or, you know, a soccer team or their kids' theater group. Now we're getting a lot of requests for drone clubs, which are becoming very popular in the local schools.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, we support those if they have, you know, if you have an advocate internally. So we strongly believe in giving back. And I'll tell you, serving on those nonprofit boards not only has been good for me personally, taught me a lot of life lessons, taught me some really good skills in terms of dealing with nonprofits, but it also means I've served with a lot of other board members who are also community leaders. So it's really a great networking opportunity. And those are friendships and in some cases partnerships that you will never lose even after you stop serving on that particular board, because they'll remember you. They'll remember you as somebody who cares and somebody that wants to do something to help.
Yeah, and once again, it relates back to the second strand of three strands leadership of meaningful work. If I'm an employee of your organization and I say, hey, will you support this thing that I believe in? That's really meaningful to me that you will support that and, you know, make it a priority, as you say. And once again, it ties into the third strand of sincere gratitude. You're telling me you value me as a member of your team when you do that. Now, I wanted to make certain we fit something in here. Your wife, Ronnie, is, you know, balances you in the organization there, and you have a husband-wife team. Not many people can do that, and you guys seem to have knocked it out of the park with the way that you work together. And I'm just curious, what can you give as comments, advice, whatever, for people that may have a spouse that is working with them, and how to make that work effectively?
Yeah, sometimes my friends who don't know us and find out that we work together and have been working together for 15 years are amazed. They're like, there's no way I could work with my wife. Go home at night, much less work with her all day and then go home and spend, you know, literally 24 hours together. And it's all about balance, quite honestly. It's about respectful balance in the workplace and at home. That is, you got to give each other the, you know your roles in the organization, you know your level of understanding of each other's roles, and you let the other person do what they need to do and don't interfere. You obviously have conversations, and we have some very animated discussions, shall we say, at times.
Yeah, I like that word, animated.
About certain topics. But the thing that works for us is, you know, I'm an avowed optimist. Nothing in the world is a challenge. It's all an opportunity to me. Whereas Ronnie isn't a complete pessimist, but she's more of a realist. So she's the thing that keeps me anchored when I say, hey, I just figured out we should be doing this awesome new thing and I want to talk to the team about it tomorrow. She'll say, first off, write it down. Figure out how it's going to work. When you have it all in your head and you tell me and I agree that we can do it, then we'll tell everybody. And sometimes that means that my idea that I would be running into the office on Monday to tell everybody about might take a month or so to the event, you know, to flesh out. But it's a good check and balance because otherwise, you know, in an organization as small as ours, as much as I try to bring in other managers who will challenge me, who will be willing to say no to me, the reality is when you're the boss, a lot of people know when they can say no and they know when not to say no. Well, Ronnie feels she can say no pretty much any time. So she's a very good balance on my desire to, you know, move at the speed of light. But it is really about being very respectful about each other's you know, roles, like I said, not just at work, but at home. Because sometimes I'll come home and I'll want to talk a little bit of business and she'll say, nope, not today. It's not going to happen. Or she'll want to talk business. And I'm like, you know what? I'm so burnt out. I just don't want to talk about it till tomorrow. And you respect each other and you give each other that space.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note, and I think this is a struggle for some people that are the optimists, because the people that are the analyticals don't ever want to be called a pessimist. They call themselves realists. I noticed you use that same term. And I have the same marriage dynamic going on. So, I think it's critical that here you're optimistic about an idea and Ronnie says, you know, puts the brakes on it. And it might be for a couple of days, might be for a month, might be for a year, whatever the time frame is. But you are wise enough to say, okay, here's a person I respect. I need to listen to this. I need to pause. And you have learned, which some people never learn. Mm. I mean, I run into these people. Some people never learn that, you know what? When I do pause and do what this analytical asked me to do, it gets better.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. And I think that, and the other thing, you know, I see you guys, when you go to an industry event, every industry event I see you at, Ronnie's right there.
Oh yeah.
And you guys both must come back from an event with some different things because mm-hmm. you process the information differently, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we will both attend a keynote, for example, or a presentation by a vendor, and I'll take something out of it. She'll take something completely different out of it. And, you know, and sometimes we take the same thing out of it, but from a different perspective. Like, I'll be looking at it from the standpoint of how can I turn this into an actionable policy or process or activity for the organization that can move us forward, whereas Ronnie looks at that same piece of information and says, how can we make our systems and processes internally better by using that? And so we take the same information and we look at it from two different points of view, and we have a conversation around it. And so when we come back from those industry events, for example, we always have a debrief with the management team to let them know what a value we got out of it, because we know that there's an expense and a cost to the organization for us to be able to attend these things. And we want to make sure that there's value that comes out of it. So if we can't sit down and, you know, offer at least three or four actionable pieces of information to the team that says, here's something that's going to make us better, here's something that's going to take us in a good direction, then it really is a waste of time. So we're always looking for those nuggets of information when we attend those events.
Yeah, and the way you're wired, you're seeing more the opportunity, the growth, the sense of urgency, whereas she's seeing more the risks and analyzing those to balance it out. And mm-hmm. How many employees do you have now?
Almost 40, I think.
Okay.
And I say I think because, you know, we've had two guys that we added, and then we had two guys. Actually, no, they're still with us, so technically 41. They just moved out of the area. One of the things that that's happened, you know, we're in the middle of California, and you know, California's not the cheapest place to live in, as you yourself can attest to. And so some of our guys have decided to move to other parts of the country. But what we found is that we have a very strong culture, a very strong ethic within the organization. So having them as remote workers in most cases works for us. And they love working for us, so they don't want to stop working for us. They just want to move someplace cheaper. So we have a lot of folks that started here that now work for us from Tennessee, Nevada, Washington State, Florida. So they go all over the place, but they're still ATG employees.
Yeah, and that's great that you can get them situated, get them trained, have them for a period of time in your offices. I mean, it's funny. I look at your backdrop of too many awards to fit in the bookcase, and you can see my boxed laser printer and boxes of stuff in my study. We just moved in, last Friday. So what is that, 4 days or something? Up here in Sisters, Oregon, from coming from just north of San Francisco. So similar type of thing, just, you know, reach the stage in life that we do this now or we never do it. So we're up here now, and I hope you come up and visit. But what have I missed, Lewis? I mean, if you had something to pass on to whether it's someone who's just been put in a management position or leadership position, or someone who's an entrepreneur, faced with a lot of, you know, they're very optimistic, but they're, you know, they've got risks there. You've done kind of a very effective, whether intentionally or unintentionally, kind of a lean startup model in a lot of the things, initiatives that you've done. What are some things that you've learned that you would want to pass on to people to have them think about?
First and foremost, I'd say don't take on too much all at once. There's a tendency for new leaders in particular to want to come in and you know, affect change right away. And so they want to do a bunch of stuff, and they just get scattered to the point where that lack of focus from the outside looks like the inability to get anything accomplished. So it's important to pick your battles and prioritize your battles. It's okay if you want to do 10 things, but figure out which one's first, which one's second, and which one's third. And figure out how many of them you can do at once and still maintain focus on them.
Did you ever read the thing with Steve Jobs, the one question he would ask Johnny Ives, Jonathan Ives, his designer? So whenever they were both in town, which was a fair amount of time, they would have lunch together. And Steve Jobs, one question he asked every time was, okay, what did you say no to since I saw you last? And it was that same concept. He felt that if he could get Ives focused on what was truly great instead of what was just good, that they would get where they wanted to go. So he wasn't necessarily saying, you know, the bad stuff to say no to. That's easy. But like what you're saying, prioritizing, because when you're driving and you've got this new idea or whatever, you can get spread too thin. I've done it, unfortunately. Yeah.
And entrepreneurs especially are prone to doing that because they see so much stuff that needs to be done and they see so much opportunity. They want to do it all. And they end up not getting much accomplished when they look back after a certain period of time because they try to do everything all at once. And we can get it all to about 90%, and then that's the end of it, right? And to me, it's really important if you're going to do something and spend your time and effort doing it, do it the best you can and make it happen, then move on to something else. Most of us think we can multitask, and maybe you can do one or two, maybe three big initiatives at once, as long as you got good people around you that you can hand off some of the execution part of it. But at the end of the day, people are looking toward you as the leader of the organization or the leader or manager of the department to identify what accomplishments that group has done. And it's up to you to make sure that there are some tangible accomplishments that you can point to and say, look, we're moving the ball forward. We're getting stuff done. Let's do more.
Yeah, and I think you I just thought of something. I lost it. But it's the prioritization is critical. And what you didn't say, but you indicated, that I think so many leaders forget is you are the role model. And, you know, I have leaders I have worked with who want their people to respond faster, to follow through on time, and do all these other things, but they don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they want their people to do that. And those are some basic behavioral things that they need to demonstrate to set the standard for their own people.
Yeah, I think it was Jim Collins in one of his books. I've read all of them, so I can't remember which one it was exactly, but he showed really how every organization, no matter how big or small, is a reflection of the person at the top. That, you know, you can get a new CEO at IBM, for example, tomorrow, and that organization will become completely different in a short period of time. And you think to yourself, there's, you know, tens of thousands of employees. How can one person, and yeah, sure, as a CEO, I'm sure he or she has a big role, but how can they change the culture so fast? But everybody watches you. Everybody looks toward that leader and says, okay, well, we're going to mimic them because, one, it saves our jobs. We hope that he or she likes the fact that, you know, we're doing what they want us to do. But it's just human nature. And I think as a leader, you are a role model, and you really need to think about that every day. You need to come to work prepared, knowing that you're a role model. I mean, there are days, I'll tell you, where I come into work and I didn't sleep well for some reason, or I had a bad day or a bad weekend, or something else is going on in my life. But I stop in the parking lot and, you know, I do the Samuel L. Jackson thing from the movie, right? Okay, it's time to get into character. Because you have to be the guy that can walk in the door and everybody knows, hey, things are good because Lewis is happy, because, you know, he's optimistic, he's moving forward. And if you come in gloomy and depressed, and, you know, you shut your office door and you say, leave me alone, within minutes, the entire office knows about it, and they're wondering what the hell's going on.
Yeah, there was a movie decades ago, I think it was with Roy Scheider, a jazz dance movie.
Yeah.
And had drugs and different things stuff going on. But every morning he went into the mirror and he said, it's showtime, folks.
It's showtime. All That Jazz. One of my favorite movies of all time.
What was it called?
All That Jazz.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember when I first got into the industry, I was doing trade shows, and there was a guy who did the local trade shows, the Marin County Fair or something with this. Oh, the Marin County Home Show with this gal, and he was advising me. And the one piece of advice he harped on over and over and over again, he said, Dave, whether your show is a success or a failure, when you walk out on the show floor, you will always have a smile on your face, and you will always act like everything is going according to plan, that everything is just fine. And then you can talk candidly with people, but you always want to be a smile on your face and be comfortable. And I don't think he was so much asking me to be fake, but he was, you know, I had to exude confidence that things were going to work out, things were going that way.
Well, and when you're on those trade show floors, you know, nobody wants to walk over and talk to the gloomy guy, right?
So yeah, that's right. Well, and particularly as the show producer, you know, you walk around with a scowl on your face, the exhibitors are going, I wonder what's going on. You know, another thing that strikes me, going back to Jim Collins, is that what you said about, you know, this CEO, everybody will then reflect the CEO. Then you think about his original work with Good to Great, where he narrowed it down to, what was it, 14 companies out of 11,000. Mm-hmm. And every single CEO of those companies shared one trait. Do you remember what that was?
No, I don't recall.
Humility.
Ah, that's right.
And here you had R.J. Reynolds making tobacco, and you had John Deere making tractors, and you know, all these different types of companies. But when they looked at the CEO, the one trait they had in common was humility, and you think about that as a role model trait, and then being picked up by the whole organization, and then those are the only organizations that were good to great under his criteria. I think it's an interesting thing to consider how we behave as leaders.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're always in the spotlight. That's one of the things we can never forget, and it doesn't matter whether you're in the office or you're maybe at the, you know, the annual holiday party or at an event someplace. You are a reflection of the organization, and the organization is a reflection of you. And so if you look internally and you're not happy with your culture, you're not happy with the way things are happening, take a look in the mirror. There's probably something that you're doing to lend, credence to that situation. And you're the one that needs to change first before you can change the rest of the organization.
And you know what? I'd love to talk to you for another hour, but I want to end on that one because that is so important. That when there's something wrong, and Lewis, wouldn't you comment also that if you can learn that behavior, it will not only positively affect your company, but also your personal life.
Amen to that.
When you've got something going on with another individual, if you can deal with yourself first, that's it. You'll have a better opportunity to resolve that. So any last comments? Otherwise, I think I'll wrap this up. This has been great. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for thinking of me for the first one of these. I look forward to seeing many more and maybe coming back at some point in the future.
Yeah, and as you're talking, I'm thinking, I got to send this to so-and-so. I got to send this to these people. And this is really good. So this is No Bad Bosses. And No Bad Bosses, a bad boss, quote unquote, is not someone necessarily who's mean or cruel. It's often somebody who's inconsistent and untrained. And it comes back to habits. And so No Bad Bosses, these podcasts are to help everyone learn some better habits to be better leaders and learn what other people are doing. And thanks so much again, Lewis, for being with us. I hope you have a fantastic 2017. And you and Ronnie, come up and visit us in Sisters.
Promise. Take care, man.
Cool. Thanks.